And welcome to Always Take Notes.
A message from our sponsor, Curtis Brown Creative. If you're an aspiring author, you'll be excited to hear that this week's sponsors are Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the major literary and talent agency.
Since launching in 2011, over 200 of their students have gone on to get major book deals.
CBC run a wide range of courses covering a variety of topics and genres. If you're interested in bringing your true stories to the page, why not join their six-week online writing a memoir course with exclusive teaching videos, resources, and writing tasks from best-selling author Kathy Rensenbrink.
By the end of the course, you'll have written at least the first 3,000 words of your memoir and developed a plan for the rest of the book. Plus, all students will be given the opportunity to get individual feedback from one of CBC's expert nonfiction editors.
Visit www.curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more about all the courses on offer.
If you're ready to learn new writing skills with an online course, there is an exclusive discount for Always Take Notes listeners. Use the code ATN20 for £20 off the full price of writing your memoir or any other 4, 5, or 6 week online course. Visit www.curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, Rachel and myself spoke with the nature writer and novelist Helen MacDonald.
We spoke to Helen about her huge success with H's for Hawk, about writing about the natural world in poetry, journalism and non-fiction, and about Prophet, her new novel co-written with Sin Blaché.
It's a great episode and we hope you enjoy it.
Welcome, Helen, to Always Take Notes. It's fantastic to have you on the show. Could we start with your new novel, Prophet? It's a bit of a departure of genre, I assume, from what people would know you as writing. So could you tell us a little bit about how that project came about and why you wanted to work in sci-fi?
It's a hysterical story. So I've always loved sci-fi. It's been a kind of something that I've read since I was a kid. I used to go out to charity shops and come home with hauls of kind of Amazing magazine and Isaac Asimov and stuff. And so it's always been there. It's just not what I was writing. And during lockdown, I had planned to go out to a remote atoll in the Pacific to write a book about Midway, this extraordinary ex-naval base full of albatrosses. But I couldn't go. I was stuck at home drumming my fingers. And I started chatting with an internet friend called Sin. And Sin Blaché is a very cool person who lives in Ireland and has never really written any books, but has always written all their lives. Lots of kind of horror and sort of sci-fi stuff. And we were talking a lot just on Twitter about, you know, where we are now and what we like to watch and what we saw. And she was playing a computer game called Control, which is a really cool computer game about a secret government agency full of secret sort of objects full of unearthly power. And we sort of talked about that and about nostalgia. And the more we talked, the more we thought, you know, we really want to tackle this sort of notion of what nostalgia is in our culture and what it, you know, the sort of dark political sort of aspects of it. But most of all, we wanted to write something fun. We sort of decided to start writing this sort of what I thought was going to be a novella, which ended up being this huge sci-fi book. And it was so much fun to write. We wrote most of it genuinely through direct messages on Twitter. We'd send each other bits, scraps and character ideas backwards and forwards, and then whole chapters. And it was really fun because, you know, there I was writing with this person who I'd never met. And they'd write back and sort of say, oh, I don't think this bit's so good, you know. And some little part of me was sort of saying, I can't believe I'm being told what to write. I'm an award-winning writer. I mean, how obnoxious is that? And I started laughing at this terrible sense. So basically, they're a genius, an absolute genius, particularly at characterization and dialogue. And we just wrote this huge book. It was a surprise. I'm not really sure what the nature writing crowd are going to think of it. It's very subversive. There's lots of swearing and it's really fun. So we're both really, really proud of it. And it's just a sort of joyful thing that, you know, I didn't even get to meet my co-author until the book was nearly finished. And luckily we got on like a house on fire. So that's the story of Prophet.
Just expanding a bit on what you're saying, I mean, how did this process of writing jointly work? I mean, did you, who was sort of pulling together the master document and things like that? I mean, how, yeah, really, we love to lift the lid on this kind of thing.
Yeah. So it started off, as I said, with just Twitter conversations, private messages. And then we started kind of writing bits and pieces and keeping separate files on Scrivener, which both of us use. It's, you know, the most phenomenal piece of writing software. We quickly realized as the manuscript as was got longer that we needed a joint document. So we created a file in Google Docs and shared it. And it was always kind of fun to watch each other edit it in real time, sort of staring there, saying, I can't believe they're changing that bit there. But it requires, I've talked a lot about this with Sin, it requires a lot of vulnerability to write like this and a lot of sort of bravery. But there's a sort of sense that once we kind of nailed down chapters and we were really happy with them, there's a kind of strength to the co-writing product it's really astonishing to me now, looking back at it, that we really don't know who wrote which parts of the book now. It's become a sort of seamless enterprise. Although, you know, it was quite fun. A lot of the American characters I had problems with because, you know, I'd sort of give them lines out of Jane Austen and Sin would laugh at me and say, no, Helen, that's not what Americans sound like. But watching the thing come together quite organically was astonishing. So I think a lot of the plotting, the main beats of the story were there from the beginning. We worked on that sort of quite early on. But a lot of it came organically as we wrote. And a lot of that was actually spurred from Sin writing conversations between the main characters, just working from their characters. And then we sort of build scenes around those conversations, which was a way of working I've never done before. You know, being a nature writer, I just sort of tend to go out and wander around and look at things and then come back and write about them. So it was, life-changing, I think. A kind of writing I honestly never thought I'd write horror. I never thought I'd write sci-fi. I never thought I'd write romance or thriller. And this book is kind of all of the genres mashed together. And the genre thing is really important, I think, because there's a lovely line from an Instagram post from the novelist Sarah Perry. And she said that she really loves the beauty, the nobility and the veracity of tropes. And I thought that was such an astonishing sentiment, you know, that we all sort of are bathed in these things and we wanted to take these tropes and sort of play with them and make something a little bit subversive out of them. So, yeah, it was a joy, the whole thing.
I find your description of watching someone else edit your work in Google Docs fun, amusing, because it's my idea of hell. But in terms of your writing process, I read that you are quite eager to edit. I mean, you described writing H for Hawk, which we'll get onto later, and you said you edited constantly as you were writing then. Was it a similar sort of thing here?
That's a really good question. I think initially a lot of my writing prose, the sort of methodology, I guess, came from writing poetry. I started off as a poet, and I always feel when writing a poem, it's a bit like sort of putting a watch together. There comes a point where you tinker and tinker and tinker and suddenly it starts working and snaps shut and you can't really do anything more to it. And that's a really sort of brilliant moment when you're writing a poem. You think, oh, it doesn't want me anymore. I can let it go. It's a live thing. And prose was like that for me. So with H is for Hawk, I really did start from the beginning and then just write and write and write. And I wouldn't leave a paragraph alone until I felt that it sort of snapped shut. And then I'd put the next link on with the next paragraph. And one of the things I had to do with that book is I had to read it from the beginning every time I sat down to write until the bit where I'd stopped the day before, which meant that towards the end of writing that book, it took quite a long time to get down to work. But there was a sort of sense that the book had an arc, had a shape that I needed to have in my mind before I could continue with the next section. So it was and it wasn't like that, in that there was another mind at play. And I think trying to navigate that, there were a few things that we'd write bits of the book that were for sort of later on in the book and then piece them together. And that's something I've never done before. And that was quite scary for me. It's like, why am I writing chapter 60? Like, how does that work? But it turns out that there's more than one way to skin a cat, as the saying goes. And I'm really happy with discovering a new way to write.
Can I ask, what was the reaction of your sort of professional people, so your agent, your publishers, stuff like that, when Helen MacDonald, acclaimed Nature writer, announced that she had written a sci-fi story?
Yeah, I'm kind of grinning here. Yeah, there was some consternation. So my agent is the astonishing Bill Clegg. He's based in New York. And, you know, he was surprised and I think a little cautious. I sent him some work, you know, some of the pages. And then suddenly he was like, oh, no, let's, you know, I think you should continue writing this. And he was really helpful, actually. One of my favorite moments in the entire construction of this book was this one Zoom that I did with Sin. And Sin hadn't really met Bill before. And, you know, they were very nervous. And I was very nervous about, you know, we sent him a whole load of pages with these ridiculous characters that, you know, doing ridiculous things. One of the characters is an American sort of field agent for the Defense Intelligence Agency. You know, he's kind of scary, kind of Jason Bourne type. We sent all these pages and had a Zoom and we were waiting for all this terrible, you know, feedback. We thought, you know, maybe he's going to say, you have to junk this, this isn't going to work. You know, maybe you need to sort of completely rethink the story. And he said, well, you know, I just think you need to make Adam hotter and more dangerous. And we were like, okay, we can do that. So it was a ride. The whole thing was surprisingly smooth in terms of it being accepted as a new genre for me. But yeah, I do think that it's not my usual audience. So I'm kind of interested in meeting a whole new kind of constituency of readers. You know, a lot of my readers tend to be, you know, in this country anyway, tend to be sort of quite well off white kind of middle class people. And one of the things I love about sci-fi is it's so increasingly so, it's such an inclusive genre, and much younger as well. So not that I don't love my nature writing readers, but I'm really excited to reach different audiences.
And in terms of sort of further logistics, did Sin have an agent or was the book sort of all handled through yours? And how did it work with the advance? Was it split completely equally?
Yeah, right from the beginning, the book is genuinely 50-50. It's not a sense of sort of, as you know, just trying to describe, it's not like nothing was ghostwritten or it wasn't me putting down Sin's ideas or vice versa. So from very early on, we said to Bill, you know, this needs to be 50-50 split. You know, absolutely down the line. And so that's what we did. And Bill represents Sin in this book. And yeah, no, it's worked pretty well. And it's just kind of, I don't know, I'm still surprised that this book that was a kind of lockdown refuge from the misery and despair of the pandemic has become a real live thing. It's sort of, you know, keep pinching myself.
Could we roll back now from the new project to your early life and particularly, you know, where your interest in birds and sort of matters natural came from? I love this line that you talked about growing up in Surrey. It was made of pine forests, golf courses, elderly army officers with parade ground voices, conservative clubs and tea dancers. Tell us a bit about your, you know, where you came from. And then there's another thing that we found that you would literally cling to the wire at a local aviary. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember that. It was a garden centre on the A30. And I was so desperately obsessed with birds. They were kind of my special interests. I would sort of eat, sleep and think about them all the time. Well, as I did eat birds, I suppose. That's kind of true, I guess. But yeah, so I'd badger my parents to take me to this garden centre again. And they had this tiny aviary with, you know, a few kind of drab zebra finches in it and maybe like a quail on the bottom wandering around. And I just stand there transfixed watching these birds. They were so mesmerizingly different, so other. And I was the kid that was obsessed with dinosaurs. So I guess it's a natural, you know, kind of way to attach that love of dinosaurs to something that's alive now. And you know, I really did walk around from very early age with a pair of binoculars around my neck. I had this pair of quite heavy but small East German binoculars and they were just me. I didn't go anywhere without them. I even go to London with them on. You know, they were kind of like my sort of, you know, some kids have teddy bears. I had my pair of binoculars. So I was quite a quirky child. But that early love of birds and nature was very much, I think, spurred by the conditions in which I was raised. So I've written a bit about this in the collection Vespa Flights. My parents are both hard-bitten journalists. My dad was a photojournalist. And they bought this house in a strange kind of old-school country estate slap-bang in the middle of Camberley in Surrey. And it was sort of faded, sort of formal parkland and a meadow and sort of all looking kind of a little bit sad. And it was owned by the Theosophical Society, which, as you know, is a sort of 19th century esoteric organisation. And it was full of these wonderfully eccentric old ladies and, you know, and people. And basically, I ran wild in this environment. It was like a real 19th century children's book. And I got into trouble for sort of going to the pond and catching newts. And I'd bring snakes home, much to the consternation of my parents, and spend a lot of time in this meadow. And I think one of the things that's very important for a writer is a sort of sense of scale. And a sense of an ability to decenter your own place in the world. You know, a lot of the stories I love most in fiction are those in which people or the main characters think that they are the main character of the story. And then later on, they discover that actually they're just a bit player in someone else's story. And that was the experience I had. And it was joyful. So I'd sort of lie in the grass and stare into the bottom of the grass stems and see tiny insects the size of punctuation marks wandering around, and then I look up at the sky and see these, you know, giant clouds the size of mountains sort of passing over. And for a child whose environment was sort of schoolrooms and the rooms in houses, it was a real eye-opener to the much larger and smaller workings of the world. That was a really important thing for me.
As well as binoculars, you also carried around notebooks, and you've spoken about writing dreadful poetry and stories when you were young. Was that writing mostly nature-focused at that time as well?
No, I mean, yes and no. I was thinking about that the other day, actually, because I had this sort of trove of, looking back on it, really quite dubious books of stories for children. It was kind of, you know, like sort of 1932 Daily Mail stories for kids. And I became obsessed with the Willard Price books of, you know, the Willard Price adventure books, which, you know, two posh American boys going around the world catching animals for zoos. I loved those books.
I read those.
I'm so glad, Simon, because they were amazing. And a lot of my early natural historical knowledge came directly from those books. And I was the kind of kid that would just come out with facts about, you know, giant clams.
One has the impression they weren't possibly helping the natural world by sort of scooping everything up in their nets.
They certainly weren't, but they definitely appealed to the acquisitive small person that I was. And yeah, I used to do this thing at school, and I still feel guilty about it. We used to have to write stories at school. And I used to just basically rewrite everything that I read, you know. I mean, I think I got into trouble once when I sort of started to write a story that was about a hobbit. You know, the teacher was like, oh, hang on a minute, you know. But I just assumed that none of the teachers would have read all the books that I'd read, which is really quite obnoxious, actually. But I used to just, yeah, sort of rewrite these stories. And there was a lot of stuff about, you know, being on a yacht in the South Pacific, you know, catching tropical fish. And yeah, so there's a kind of, I always feel there's a bit of fraudulence to my early writing. It was all a bit mimetic rather than creative, because at that time I wanted to be an artist. You know, that's all I wanted to be. I, you know, I was obsessed with painting and drawing, and that sort of desire to be an artist sort of continued right the way through until university, really. And I think it's really affected my writing, that sort of visual sense. So, you know, when I look at a landscape now, I'm instantly trying to sort of block in color values and work out how you would approach it as a picture or a painting. And I think that's very much how I think about writing, about sort of scenery and atmosphere, is, you know, the visual is very important to me.
So you then did English at university and you then did postgraduate study. Were you thinking at that time that you wanted to be an academic, or was there a different set of reasoning?
Simon, again, I think I'm singing like a canary today. Genuinely, my route through life has been a desperate attempt to not be bored. You know, I did an English degree at Cambridge. I really liked that. But there was another half of me that was birds and science and nature. So after I did that, I disappeared off to work for a conservation organization in the Gulf States, you know, working on trying to protect the falcons used in Arab falconry. So that was a, you know, not the sort of thing that you normally do after an English degree. But then I got kind of bored with that because I wasn't thinking. So then I came back to do an MPhil in the history of science. And I really thought at that point that I found my métier, because, you know, I was really fascinated when I was a undergraduate about, you know, discovering critical takes on books, you know, how to read a book and see in a book there's always much more than the author intended. You know, you get this window onto the social mores of the time and the kinds of things that are going on there. And I realized that I could, in the history of science, look at, say, the history of natural history or the history of biology and sort of see the same social things going on underpinning the science. So that was really fascinating. And I think that really informed a lot of the way I look at the natural world. But as I went through that process, you know, I started a PhD, but I didn't finish it because I got really fed up with knowing that all these amazing theories and facts and phenomena that I was encountering in that world were always going to stay inside the academy. And I just thought, I want to write for everyone. It really was that simple. And, you know, I remember speaking to my mum about it and she was like, you know, but it's not a steady job. And I'm like, yeah, but it's what I really want to do. So I took the plunge. Yeah. And it's worked out okay so far.
Where did your first collection of poetry published in 2001 fit into this in terms of the timeline?
Yeah. So when I was at university, I hung out with a whole bunch of sort of reprobate Cambridge poets. And back in that day, they really were kind of, you know, it's all red wine and Baudelaire.
I think it's still like that now.
It's still like that now. Yeah. I remember going...
I mean, I can't speak to it, but when I was at university, it was still a lot like that.
I remember going to dinner once with a family and the lady of the household was complaining about poets. She was like, don't ever invite them round, Helen. They're a nightmare. They get drunk and smash your furniture and they just talk about themselves all the time. I was like, okay, Kate. But I really was interested in this Cambridge poetry, which is this really linguistically sort of challenging, kind of thorny, difficult poetry from Jeremy Prynne, you know. And I thought it was fascinating in the way that, a cryptic crossword is fascinating. And people often talk about it as if it's this sort of, you know, very obscure, quite off-putting kind of elite type of poetry. But I always found it to be more like a crossword puzzle, like what's going on here? You're like the watch metaphor. I wanted to sort of pull it apart and see what was doing. And I ended up writing a lot of poetry when I was at university, partly because I was interested in taking the kind of grand cadences of lyric poetry and then sort of stuffing it full of technical vocabulary and stuff that shouldn't be there. It was really fun to do. And partly because I was an incredibly miserable bastard when I was at university and poetry was a very good way to, you know, mope. So I did that as well. And that book came out, the collected poems came out after, I hadn't written much poetry for a long while. That was just sort of collected stuff. There was some interest in it. And I was really pleased to see it out. It's very strange to read it now. You know, I feel that I'm in contact with a sort of past self that doesn't really know what they want to say yet, you know, but is having a lot of fun with words.
We are thrilled to announce the publication of Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers. The book, edited by the two of us, features contributions from almost 100 past guests on the podcast. It's a distillation of the wit and wisdom we've heard over the past 6 years.
The book offers, we think, frank and entertaining guidance on writing in particular and living a creative life in general. It answers questions such as, where do the best ideas come from? How do you stay motivated? What does it take to become a published author? And how do you actually make money from your writing?
Published by Ithaca Press, Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers is available from October 12th in all good bookshops. We hope you enjoy reading it.
And how did Falcon come about, your book in 2006? We're always interested in the show in the kind of mechanics of agents and book deals and stuff like that. So how did that get off the ground?
I didn't have an agent at that time, so this is a cautionary tale. I was approached by the series editor at a table in the university library tea room. So this is one of those stories, of course, of sort of privilege and being in the right place at the right time. And, you know, as you know, a lot of it works like that, you know. And I think of my co-writer, you know, Sin. You know, Sin is a genius writer, but has never been in a situation where she's been in contact with the people that would open doors for her. So, you know, I was very lucky being at university to know people who, you know, edited book series. And he said, like, let's write a book. And I said, yes. And then, you know, I got my advance of £300 or whatever it was, or I think it was £350. which was like later discovered, you know, probably would need an agent, and wrote the book. It was really fun. I wrote a lot of it on a holiday with my mum and dad went to Italy, Lake Garda. And I'm like a bit of a vampire with Scottish blood. So they all went out in the sun and I kind of sat in my hotel room and typed on my ancient laptop. And that was really fun. That was a lot of the stuff from my academic work that was too fun really to go into academia. There's a lot of stories and anecdotes. But reading that now, it's a really strange book. It's like it's trying to be a popular book, but I'm still kind of caged in with, I think, a lot of a desire to be clever. Right. I'm using a lot of academic jargon. I'm kind of trying. I'm pleased with the book, but it doesn't seem to. There was a lesson I learned when I wrote Ages of a Hawk, and that was to be as authentic and as honest as possible and as grounded in oneself as possible. And I hadn't got anywhere near that when I wrote Falcon. So it's fun, but it's not really me.
That was my next question about academic versus non-academic writing. So we can go straight past that. And then what did you do in that period between Falcon and Ages for Hawks? So it's a sort of 7-year period in the...
Yeah. Sorry, this is so weird to think back on it all. And I got a research fellowship at Jesus College in Cambridge, and that was amazing. And then my father died suddenly, which was not amazing. And I really fell off the world. You know, we were really dear friends. He was a really great, great guy. And very, very similar as well. I think one of the things that, you know, deaths always do is sort of remind one that people that share a view of the world with you are very far, few and far between. So there was the enormous grief of his passing and also the loneliness of his passing and also sort of loneliness of feeling that sort of that eye and that brain that also encountered the world like mine had also gone. And it was just awful. It was very sudden and unexpected. And I really was a hopeless research fellow after that. I, as you might know, if you've read H's for Hawk, I went off and got a goshawk because, you know, I rather dumbly thought that the way of dealing with grief was to train a hawk. This is not a good idea. I don't recommend it, but it was a very intense situation. I got this goshawk, which is Britain's, I guess, wildest and most sort of ferocious bird of prey and most difficult to tame. And I sequestered myself away like a monk in my college house. And I sort of lived with Mabel, and we went out and I watched her fly and hunt in the Cambridgeshire countryside. And it was a very feral existence. And I kind of fell off the world even more, really. You know, people sort of say, oh, did the hawk make things better? And I'm like, well, no, you know, it's not like I was sad and then I got a cat and then I felt better. It was very much, you know, I went into the sort of underworld with this hawk. And by the end of that period, I sort of got into this state where I was sort of barely human. I really identified with this bird more than I did my friends and family, and really cut myself off from the world. And then came out of that with the help of friends and antidepressants and the passage of time. And it's, I don't know, even at the time, even while this was all happening, I knew that there was a story to this that was bigger than me and older than me. And I thought one day I'd like to write this. And it took 7 years to have enough distance to be able to do that. I needed to make myself into a character that I could write about, just as I wrote about the other character in the book, T.H. White. And that was a very peculiar experience of sort of dealing with this character that was me. And, you know, quite often I'd be sort of typing and swearing under my breath, you know, you idiot, what were you thinking? But yeah, so it took 7 years of, you know, I was sort of part-time jobs and penniless and surviving on lentils and rice and counting up tuppences down the back of the sofa. But the book came out of it, yeah.
One thing I heard elsewhere was that the THY element, the shadow biography, came in when the project was at a relatively advanced stage. Is that right? Because it's quite a structurally nuanced book, right? The moving between it. Could you tell us, like, in terms of how, you know, when White came into the picture and then how you worked out this pretty sophisticated way of moving between your narrative and his narrative?
Thank you for the sophistication comment. It felt like blundering at the time. He was always going to be in the book because I'd read his attempt to train a goshawk in the 1930s, you know, this book, The Goshawk, many years ago, and it always upset me because he, you know, basically, again, if you haven't read the book, he was a man who wasn't given any of the tools to know how to love anything, including himself. And he saw himself in this bird and kind of wanted to punish it, but wanted to love it and wanted it to love him. And it was just the most awful psychodrama that ends up with the hawk escaping kind of on purpose and flying away probably for, you know, to its doom. He was going to be in it, but then I thought, well, look, I better go over and see if I can look at his archives, which are in the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas. So there I was, this sort of, you know, I had very little money at that point. So I booked a room in a really dubious motel under a sort of underpass. I remember there was a very bad moment when I looked out the window one morning and walked down and there was a cat sort of, you know, licking up vomit in the car park. And I thought, you know, this is not the writing life I expected. So every morning I'd go to the Harry Ransom Center and sit there and go through these extraordinary diaries. And I was very lucky in that T.H. White not only had very clear handwriting, but was an extraordinarily open diarist. So he would put things in his diaries that, you know, I didn't expect. And he's a very, very problematic character in many, many ways. But I found out a lot of stuff there and I thought lots more of him has to be in the book. He really did haunt me. And the structuring was kind of easy in a way because, you know, the sort of stations of the cross, as it were, the kind of the different, you know, moments in the taming of a hawk and the winning the trust of the hawk and then getting the hawk to fly to you and then fly free. You know, that progression was sort of matched by his. So there was a kind of conversation between me and this sort of dead author and his sad bird. But I didn't want it to be a book about how, you know, I can train a hawk and he couldn't. It was much more about both of us fell into the trap, I think, of identifying far too much with a bird we'd projected all of our own brokenness into. And I think that was what really made the book, was that sense of shared sadness between me and this very different character.
I was interested when, and you've spoken and written about this, that, you know, White used his relationship with the bird as a sort of metaphor for writing about his own sexuality and self-acceptance and that sort of thing. So given you'd read that book when you were young, was that a model, you know, in terms of using writing about an animal to write about yourself, was that a model that you were conscious of working within or emulating?
I didn't understand that when I read it when I was small. I just thought he was a monster. I had all of the kind of entitlement of being a child, and I'm like, you know, he got it wrong. I think I even have a copy of the book where I would like write complaints in the margin about what he should have been doing in my sort of schoolgirl handwriting. It was much later, and I think post English degree, that I realized that there was a whole kind of genre of animal books that I'd either read or I'd heard about that was set in the 20s and 30s up to the sort of 50s, that became increasingly apparent to me were fables about being an outsider, quite often about being gay. So, you know, the Ring of Bright Water is a classic example. You know, you have Gavin Maxwell, this very sort of sad, quite bitter gay man living in a hovel in Scotland with these otters. And there's a kind of sort of way of writing about tenderness and about love that isn't the acceptable, normal, sort of straight human love, you know, that most books are about, that seems to me very, very queer in these books now. But I didn't, again, that was something that I sort of had worked out by the time I started writing Ages of a Hawk. But it is a really fascinating phenomenon. And you know, there aren't really as many books like that now. And I like to think that's because people are a lot less in need of them.
Again, on the kind of mechanics, at what stage in this journey did you get the book contract, and how did that come about? And then at what stage was it clear that this was going to be a really big hit as well?
I spent a long time writing the biggest proposal in the world. I look back on it now and I'm like, God, Helen, well, you know, what was that all about? It was like, you know, 20,000 words. I became, I had an agent at that point, Jessica Woolard, who did a phenomenal job selling that book. And so it was the first two chapters, an extraordinarily long synopsis, which, you know, sort of baffles me now. And then I, you know, put stuff in like, you know, who am I, in a CV, and, you know, it was like I was applying to be president or something, but it worked. And I had this really bizarre experience, you know, that Jessica took it around to various editors, and you know, I did this day in London, which became legendary. And I went to visit all these publishers who, you know, were interested in publishing it. And of course, you know, I was terrified. I thought I was being interviewed, so I was like really nervous. I hadn't realized that they were trying to impress me, so I was sort of shaking at these meetings. And they were all wonderful. You know, all of the publishers were, you know, there were sort of free books and there was coffee and there were sort of chocolates. And I was like, this is amazing. You know, I began to sort of think, you know, I'm going to go with the one who gives me the most chocolates, you know, or something like that. I was in this kind of bizarre sort of dream world. And then I ended up on Vauxhall Bridge Road and went to have a meeting with Jonathan Cape. And, you know, I knew already that Jonathan Cape was a huge deal. And if I went there, I'd probably be a very small fish in a big pond. But, you know, why not try it? And the managing guy there, the publishing director, Dan Franklin, who's now retired, but is just one of the loveliest men in the world and a complete legend, came down to the foyer to meet me, which none of the other people had done. And went upstairs into what felt at that time like a really big, messy newsroom from the 80s. And I grew up in newsrooms, so it was instantly familiar. It felt like home. And he said, do you want a cup of tea? And he went off himself and made me a cup of tea. And I thought, well, that's lovely. And then there were just the sort of questioning that I got from the team there was on another level. You know, they really got the book and they really, really wanted to tussle with some of the things in it. And I just thought, I really want to go with these people. And that's how it went. And then I had to write the bloody thing, which was another thing. And that took a year and a half. And there was lots of swearing and hiding under the desk and, you know, the usual writing stuff.
Was it hard to sort of replumb the depths of your griefs in the writing process? And given a bit of time had elapsed, had you kept journals or notes, you know, at the time when you had thought you might want to return to it later?
Yeah, and the relationship between the notes and the actual writing is surprising to me. So after Dad died, I started keeping a diary again in a way I hadn't done since I was a teenager. I think I was trying to sort of stitch the world back together with my writing. And then I had a hawk, so the hawk was in it. And then I had a separate diary, which was the kind of the hawk's diary of taming and, you know, events in the hawk sort of, I don't like the word training. It sounds sort of wrong. It's really getting the hawk used to you enough to be with you when it's doing its normal thing. But something happened after grief. And I think, you know, talking to many people since that time, you know, it seems to be people after a very big grief, they tend to either forget everything or they remember everything with terrible clarity. And I was one of the latter. And you know, I didn't even refer. I referred to the diary quite a lot for times and days and weather and stuff like that. But I didn't really need to. You know, I have the most astonishing recall even now of what it was like to be out with Mabel in the rain, you know, watching raindrops run down her feathery nape and the patterns of the leaves beneath my feet. So it was very surprising how clear those memories were. And I have a terrible memory, you know, so I remember at one point thinking, well, I can never write another book about anything because I'm never going to be able to remember it like I do this. So, but going back and being that person who was full of grief was easy when it was writing about the hawk and about the natural world. And it was very, very hard writing about things like, for example, going to see my father as he lay in hospital, you know. I had to just rewrite and rewrite and rewrite those. And in fact, I think I may have said elsewhere, but the book had lots of false starts. Initially, I really thought people would be less interested in me than the bird, which I'm sure they probably are, but it was a lot more British. I didn't really want to kind of, you know, tell everyone what I was feeling. I just wanted to say, look, this amazing hawk happened. Look at this thing. And I kept trying to write it and it kept running up against a brick wall. And then I remember this day that I realized that the only way to do this book was to be devastatingly honest about everything. And I'd never done that before, but it was just a moment I started writing and then it just started to flow. And I think readers know when you're not being honest and authentic. And those words are so sort of, they're so overused, but you know it when you've hit that, the bedrock of truth when you write. And that was astonishing. Yeah, the book really began to sing as soon as I thought, right, fuck it. I swore, sorry.
Swearing is absolutely fine.
That's good.
I wanted to say as well to listeners that Dan Franklin is a past guest on Always Take Notes, so you can hear an interview with him. And just on that, following on that point I raised earlier, when did you know that this was the book was going to do very well? I mean, was there a particular moment, or was it a kind of slow burn? How did that piece work?
I was so numb throughout that whole spectacular sudden, you know, event. I was excited because Waterstones picked it as a book of the month. I was like, oh, that's good. I was delighted in some of the reviews were in sort of big papers, you know, that was nice. And then suddenly it was in the bestseller list, and you know, I that whole sort of first year, I don't think I even let myself kind of enjoy it. I was just so stunned that this book was being read by so many people. It just seemed so beyond, you know, it's funny, you know, some people have told me that they write because they want lots of readers, or they write because, you know, they want people to sort of know about them or their stories or whatever. And absolutely, that's a really good way to write. But I honestly wrote this story because I wanted to write it. And I did worry quite a lot that it wouldn't sell. In fact, when I'd finished the manuscript, it took me a few days to pluck up enough courage to send it in, because I'm like, you know, this is a really weird book. You know, it's kind of all sorts of genres mixed together, and it's not that happy. You know, what have I done? Poor Dan, you know, Cape are going to be furious. And then it just went crazy. And in America too, you know, it's still an extraordinary event that happened. I'm delighted, obviously, but meeting readers on tour, I think, gave me a real idea of what might have been driving that. And it was just the number of people that came up to me after talks and told me sort of griefs and darknesses and losses that they'd experienced of a magnitude, you know, much greater than mine. And I realized, you know, it is the case that we don't really talk about grief very much. It's still a bit of a taboo subject. And the book really chimed with a lot of people who saw their experiences reflected in its pages, even though it was about a hawk. And also young mums. Did I know if I told you this? I had loads of young mums and young dads come up and tell me that the book was about having a baby. And I'm like, what? They said, you know, you're trapped in a room with a creature that doesn't talk and you don't know what it wants. And, you know, you love it and want to do your best by it, but you're really scared and isolated. And I'm like, oh yeah, no, that does sound like training a hawk. So that was really fun.
And the book went on to win prizes and, as you say, become this phenomenon. How did that change things for you, both financially and in terms of your sense of yourself as a writer?
The book winning prizes was a delight, because by that time, I really began to think of the book as something that had a life of its own. I still think of a book like this. A book is like maybe making a pot. If you're a potter, you know, you've spent years sort of training, making pots, and you make a pot and you're really pleased with it, and you fire it you glaze it and fire it. And then, you know, you put it on a shelf and then it goes off and does something by itself. It's its own thing. And I felt with the awards that the book was getting the awards, not me. And, so I was really proud of it. I was really proud of the book. And, I think the one that made me the most surprised, it won a big prize in France. So I went off to this really fancy pants thing in Paris, and it won a prize in Paris. And that was amazing. I discovered, you know, Parisian literary culture is very different from here. There was some kind of a ceremony at 10 a.m. the next morning for sort of publishers, and everyone was sort of drinking champagne and, you know, troughing down foie gras. And I'm like, God, this is amazing. You know, this is not like London. So yeah, still speechless at the life the book's had since then.
I saw in another interview as well that your cottage was sort of built on the success of that as well. You were able to buy this place in Suffolk as well.
Yes, this house that I'm in now. I've got these two parrots, and it's been a bit of a nightmare. They went through a very hormonal phase a few months ago, and they've discovered that they can go behind the books on my bookcases, and then they chew all along the books. So all of my books are destroyed now. It's a sort of, you know, hubris thing. So initially, in terms of financial stuff, I was really poor, and then the book did okay, and then it did well. And suddenly I was driving a car that didn't break down every 10 miles. So I think that was a real, really nice moment. And, yeah, I bought a house, and, you know, I never thought that would be possible. I thought I was going to rent forever. So it has led to some sense of security and that I never possessed before. That's been really lovely. And I feel really lucky with that one.
In terms of following up on a hit like that, did you find it hard to put pen to paper or indeed start typing again? Or was the itch to write so sort of strong that it didn't affect you too much?
Yeah, I've never understood that. You know, I really do hold that there are millions of different kinds of writers, and I really admire those who, you know, can't stop writing. I find it very easy to stop writing. But what was happening, you know, during the kind of tours of H's for Hawk, I had this amazingly wonderful gig with a great editor called Sasha Weiss at the New York Times Magazine, and I did a series of columns about nature, and I did features for them. And then they commissioned me to do things I would never have done on my own. You know, I went off to Chile with some space scientists who went off to the Atacama Desert to study, you know, areas that are kind of Mars analogs for the next Mars mission. And, you know, there I was kind of, you know, minus 30 swearing in my, you know, sleeping bag. So all of these things I did, and I started writing about for the New York Times, and then I discovered I really loved that essay form. I love the sense that an essay to me, you know, there's always a reader right by my shoulder. They tend to be puzzles that I'm trying to find something out, and the reader comes along with me. So I really loved writing them all, and some are written for what I decided would be a book of essays. And that was the advantage of that was that it wouldn't be something that would be compared to H's for Hawk. I couldn't write another book just like that, you know. Yeah, so this book, Vespa Flights, came out of all those pieces and thoughts I was having and experiences I had, and put it together. I'm quite fond of it as a book. It's very, people talk about it being full of hope, which is something we, you know, we really need to cling on to at this time of the sixth great extinction. And I'm glad people like it for that.
Could you tell us about this Midway project, both how it came about and then how it got sort of interrupted? I saw on Twitter that you got this alarming sounding illness, thyrotoxicosis, but maybe you could start it by telling our geographically challenged listeners where Midway is, and then perhaps we could take it from there.
Midway is astonishing. So it's a tiny, it's two tiny, tiny islands, right in the middle of the Pacific. It's like 1,500 miles northwest of Hawaii. It's possibly one of the most remote places on Earth. And it doesn't have a history of dispossession like many islands, but it was kind of a staging post on the extremely posh flying boat route from San Francisco to Shanghai. And then it became a naval, you know, station during the Second World War. As people probably know, the Battle of Midway, which took place quite close to it, when the Americans broke the Japanese naval codes, and it was a huge battle. But I first came across Midway when I was a kid reading my dad's National Geographic magazines, and there was an article from summer 1964, and it was called "The Goonie Birds of Midway," and it was like everything. It was like you know, military planes and albatrosses and birds, and you know, and it was about these crews that flew from Midway every day on these 24-hour flights, because back then they hadn't developed over-the-horizon radar, so they needed to, you know, they sort of built a ring of defense early warning line stations around the north of Alaska to detect Russian missiles coming in. But there was a whole area of the North Pacific that was completely clear of any kind of warning radar. So they would just send these planes up for 24 hours a day just to patrol the horizons to make sure that there weren't any, you know, incoming nukes. And they took off from Midway. And there was a huge battle between, you know, these albatrosses on Midway, which kept flying into the planes and, you know, whatever. And there were these photographs of this, you know, these lawns with military buildings behind them. And every 3 or 4 feet was an albatross sitting on eggs. And I was like, what is this? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, it would be the most amazing book to write, because the albatross is so already like a real symbol of kind of guilt. We've got like Coleridge's albatross, and you've got kind of Baudelaire's albatross, and we're all kind of struggling with environmental guilt. The albatrosses are being, you know, assailed by plastic pollution, by sea level changes, by weather changes. And I thought, I'm going to write a book about the end of the world. So I went off to Midway and helped with the albatross count there. Every year, the Fish and Wildlife Service does a census, which involves, you know, walking up and down for 6 weeks, clicking counters and counting albatrosses. And then you go to sleep at night and you dream of albatrosses. But it was the most extraordinary experience. You know, it's the place in Hawaiian tradition where souls are born and where souls go back to when they die. And as soon as I got off the plane, I'm like, oh, of course, you know, it's intensely kind of moving place. So I did this, and then suddenly I got really sick. I got really weak, and I got this lump in my throat, and I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't sleep. And then the doctor called me over at lunch one time in the sort of canteen and said, will you come to my doctor's sort of facility on the island? And he took my resting heart rate, it was like 125 or something. And he looked at me and said, you have a goiter. I'm like, isn't that a medieval disease? And he went, yeah, you've got thyroid toxicosis. You have to go home now. And I'm like, but, you know, I've got another week. And he went, you have to go home now or you might die. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I came home in a hurry with lots of unfinished business. So that was my exciting adventure on Midway. But it really is amazing. I can't wait to go back. I should go back this winter, I hope, to do that again and not get sick this time and write the book.
We're coming towards the end of our time, so a couple of last questions from me. One is what your assessment of nature writing as a genre is today. You've described it in the past as a bit of a boys' own club. So, you know, are there any writers working within the genre today that you think are sort of evolving and doing interesting things within that space? And secondly, and sort of relatedly, you've said in the past your ultimate subject is love. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about why you think that.
Nature writing is getting a lot better. It's such a hated term, isn't it, nature writing? You know, you've got writers sort of, you know, oh, not a nature writer. it has a bad rap. It has had a, you know, it's been interrogated a lot, as you know, for being overly white, overly middle class, you know, overly the kind of writer that will point out a plant and basically say, aren't you lucky to have me to explain this to you? I love those writers, by the way, and that voice that they use is very easy to fall into when you write about nature. It's a bit like when you do sort of documentary filming, you end up sounding like David Attenborough. You can't help it, you know, that's what it is. But there's so many more voices now from, you know, people of colour, black writers, trans writers, you know, it's queer writers. It's like a really, really sort of booming set of writers now that are coming up that are really showing something which should be obvious to everyone, and that is that nature doesn't belong to any one person or one type of person. It belongs to all of us, and the ways we approach it and think about it vary hugely, and we need all those voices more than ever now. So I mean, the book that I generally go to when I want to get across like something that everyone should read, well, there's Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass, which has had a huge success. And then an amazing book called Home Place by J. Drew Lanham, which is about a book about land and birds by a black ornithologist from America. It's exquisite. So those are two really good. But that, you know, just go to the shelves. There's lots of really great books coming. What was the second question?
Love, writing about love.
Oh, yes, love. Yeah, I write about love. Like, why would you want to write about anything else? I mean, having said that, you know, the book about albatrosses is going to be about the end of the world, and part of me is kind of like, you know, love and death are so closely, you know, entwined that maybe I write about death and love. I don't know. But I just think there's so much joy to be had in paying attention to the natural world and trying to understand the kind of very complicated systems that surround us, that are invisible to us, that why would I don't really want to write elegiacally about them, or I don't really want to write about them in terms of sort of science. I want to write about them in terms of emotional connection and love and joy, because that's what spurs people, you know. And then this science fiction novel is a giant queer love story. You know, the book is very much about the dangers of nostalgia, and about, you know, it's about the weaponization of nostalgia by a secret government military project. But at heart, it's a giant love story. And, you know, I just think things are really, really rough. The world is full of very bad things right now. That sounds extremely kind of like trite, but it's grim out there. So if you're going to tie yourself to anything, I think it should be love.
And a final question for me is about your future plans. You've mentioned the Albatross. What else is on your horizon when it comes to writing and other things?
Well, Sid and I are hoping to write a TV series from Prophet, which will be really fun. And then Midway, which is going to be, I cannot wait to get into that. And then I'd really love there to be more books in the sci-fi series with the same characters, as a kind of, you know, I sort of see it now, my kind of writing career of sort of working in parallel. You know, there'll be the sort of big nature books and the nonfiction books, and then this really delightful other kind of book that is just a very different way of writing and a different thing altogether. I've always sort of felt that my life's always been divided into sort of two things. So it's always, you know, back in the day it was nature and literature. And then the two came together in Ages for Hawk. And now I think it's like, you know, sci-fi and nature. And I'm going to try and keep those things running in parallel, I think.
Or you could bring them together as well. Constant merging.
Well, it's true. I mean, you know, a lot of the greatest ecological kind of takes at the moment are written as science fiction. You know, Jeff Vandermeer, you know, for example, see Pam Zheng. You know, those books are phenomenal works about the environment.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us today. I'm wishing you all the very best of luck with all of your different projects going forward.
Thank you. It's been a joy. Thank you very much.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Helen McDonald. She's on Twitter at Helen J. McDonald, and Prophet is published by Jonathan Cape. Hello, it's us again. Simon, what was your takeaway from the interview with Helen?
Well, she's someone we've been hoping to get on the podcast for a while, so I was very pleased that we were able to interview her. I read Ages for Hawk the year it came out, I think, and I found it very powerful and very beautiful. So it's great to talk about that book and the process of bringing it together. And then also her kind of drastic change of direction with this new project, which we did the interview a little while ago, and it's been good and heartening to see that has been well received. Rachel, what about you?
Agreed. I thought Helen was a funny and lively guest. I enjoyed the conversation very much. I wanted to ask more about form and grief and the process of putting those words together on the page. But I enjoyed her metaphor in terms of staying motivated, that it's like wading through treacle. And anyway, I thought it was an arresting image. What have you been up to, Simon?
I've been today talking to a man who's hopefully going to build me some shelves, which is one of my favorite things to do. So that has been interesting.
And one of your favorite things to do is to talk to men who are going to build you shelves.
Yeah, yeah. What could be more exciting than commissioning shelving? You know, there's so many interesting issues.
To be fair, that is quite exciting.
It is quite exciting. Yeah. Like, you know, issues of depth, material, adjustability. I'm not.
I hope you're going for, was it 4 degrees?
Well, I was just going to say, I'm not going for an angle, I don't think, because it's not for display or commercial concerns such as that. So, so I'm looking forward to that, because my books, or as my girlfriend puts it, my friends are currently in storage, and I think it's time for them to be rescued. And in fact, we can talk about this now, can't we? So we have recorded the audiobook version of our book, which is very exciting, and which you should have heard a little ad for. So that's coming out, and we're very much looking forward to that coming into the world. And then in Matters Cultural, our cultural digest, I finished this big French history of art book that I was reading. And I'm now reading a book called Racing Weight, which is about nutrition for endurance sport, which I'm sure is there are some listeners, although perhaps not that many, who are interested in that. Anyway, Rachel, what about you? What have you been up to, and what have you been consuming?
Well, what I've been up to, I think hopefully hopefully the book gives some context for my slightly rubbish responses to this question earlier this year, because we spent the first probably 6 months of this year working on it, right? And then
and we couldn't tell anyone.
And it couldn't tell anyone, and it consumed quite a lot of time. So I had been working on things, but I couldn't talk about them. So what have I been up to? Obviously, I'm back from holiday. I did lots of reading there. I read a book called Monsters by Claire Dederer, which is about art that we love by problematic figures and what we should do and how we should feel about it, which was interesting.
Did you read Night Bitch? I looked that up after you.
I did read Night Bitch, yes.
Which is about a woman who changes into a dog after dark.
She turns into a dog, yes. But then sort of turns back and becomes a sort of half dog, half woman.
Easily done.
And in the end, it's sort of a piece of performance art. It was interesting. It was very funny, but I was on my holiday, I was with a big group of people and it elicited some sort of quite amused responses. Yeah, so I read that and I read Claire Keegan's new short story called So Late in the Day, and I read Paris Echo by Sebastian Foulkes. So lots of reading.
Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Aiken.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jess Danheiser, and our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Twitter at Take Notes Always. We're on Instagram at Always Take Notes. If you'd like to support us on our crowdfunding page on Patreon, we're on there under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.